We've got 20 minutes left. I can't march through all of this in 20 minutes. I'm not going to see what would be the most useful. I think the discussion of if class is the answer, what's the question, those questions, I think that's pretty clear in the text. So I don't see there's much advantage of me just simply going through those. Let me briefly talk about the way I've located different class concepts in the from paradigm battles to integrated class analysis in that paper, and then go through what I've described as a kind of step-by-step guide to building a Marxist concept of classes. So if you were to simply work in that particular conceptual space, what are the logical steps by which you build up the more complex concept, which then enables you to understand varieties of Marxist approaches. They would have different ways of specifying different parts of this step-by-step process. So first, the paradigms battle paper. That paper was written for a conference in South Africa at the beginning of the summer, in which I was basically asked to write another piece on class, and they wanted it to be something that I didn't simply take off the shelf and wanted. You know, initially, that was almost the reason not to go to the conference. but I decided, all right, what if I were to go beyond that, the previous last thing I had written was the class is the answer, what is the question, the conclusion of that book. And at the very end of that book, there was this little slightly glib paragraph where I essentially said you could be a Bourdieuian in the morning and Hegelian in the afternoon and Marxist in the evening, kind of playing off of Marx's famous quip about being a critical critic in the evening and a fisherman, whatever, I forget the sequence, in the morning, about being the division of labor. And I decided to write a paper where I took that point seriously by reframing the if class is the answer, what is the question chapter into a specification of different clusters of causal mechanisms that get associated with the concept of class, and to try to show how you could put those together within a broader framework. And that's what led to that, essentially that diagram at the end where you have a micro and a macro account of class with the dynamic property of the class struggles that come out of that model, reshaping the starting point, that is the distribution of powers with respect to economic resources. I think that's provisionally a reasonably effective way of showing how these different class concepts fit together. They're based then on three clusters that are located in this broader conceptual space. One cluster identifies the concepts of class with individual attributes and conditions of life, rather than with relations. So it's centered around attributes of persons, but it includes attributes that are defined by their conditions of life. So to be poor is both, you can think of that as an attribute of a person, it's a poor person, or you can think of it as a characteristic of their conditions of life. It's a person who lives in poverty. Those are the very individualistic definitions of class. There's no causal connection between the conditions of life of one person and another in those descriptions. They typically correspond to analyses of class which, when talking about how can we reduce the inequalities that come from class, how can we reduce poverty, emphasize how can we change the people. And the most prominent form of that is the view that if only we could improve the human capital, the education, that has changed that particular attribute of people, then we would eliminate that aspect of class which is most morally troubling, namely poverty. It's an individualistic account of class, which leads to individually targeted solutions for the problems of the class. As a standalone concept, I think it's terribly impoverished. As a standalone concept, it has been the primary way that class has been thought about in sociology and continues to be thought about. And most people who talk about class talk about the conditions of life of people. The poor are poor because of their conditions of life and their attributes, rather than the poor are poor because the rich are rich. The kind of symbolist relational idea is that there's a causal connection between the advantages of some and the disadvantages of others. And that causal connection is systematic and relational, as opposed to haphazard and contingent. Now, one reaction to the superficiality of that concept of class is just to dismiss it out of hand, to say, that's not class, that's something else. Of course, there are rhetorical contexts in which that's a perfectly reasonable stance. But more broadly, I think it is in fact the case that when Marxists engage in various kinds of class analysis, they also talk about class in that simple way. It's not that they don't recognize that the simple conditions of life of people stamp their lives in all sorts of ways that matter for their consciousness, for their relations to other people, for all sorts of things. And the criticism, therefore, is not so much that we shouldn't consider individual attributes and conditions of life as an aspect of class analysis, but it's only one aspect. That's why at the end of the Paradigms paper, I make the point that if you fully accept this idea that there are these three clusters of class concepts, the individualistic attributes, class as opportunity hoarding, which is essentially the invariant family of class concepts, and class as exploitation and domination, which for purposes of this paper I did not feel was crucial to separate. For other purposes I do, but for this, they really are very closely connected to each other. I said at the end of the paper that it's a much easier job for Marxists to formally recognize the relevance of these other mechanisms than it is for stratificationists. For stratificationists to recognize the importance of exploitation is to recognize the importance of something they utterly ignore and that hasn't played any role in their theoretical and empirical work. Whereas for Marxists, they recognize the importance of human capital and individual attributes as one face of a class analysis is to actually just give more explicit recognition to something that's included anyway. So even though the paper is written from this kind of ecumenical big tent perspective, it's a big tent which if everybody bought into would be not quite my earlier fantasy of defeating the bourgeois rival and having him change horses, but it would be at least part of that fantasy realized. I suppose one implication of what I just said is that the paper is a little sneaky. You know, I suppose there's two kinds of readings that you can have with the paper. If you're a really hardcore Marxist, you can see me as selling out because I've given legitimacy to theoretical positions which I've been very hostile to. Or you can see me as really sneaky, because I've given legitimacy to them, but on a terrain in which the legitimacy is contingent upon their acceptance of the centrality of the Marxian mechanisms to the whole structure. You can decide what judgment to place on the paper in light of that. It's being published in UF Review. I suspect I will get a lot of flack for it from some quarters. We'll
can I ask a question about that?
Yeah.
I wondered, given the sneakiness, why you would have published it in New Left Review, a Marxist, largely Marxist or sympathetic to Marxist audience, rather than bourgeois journal, to try to get that audience as much
right.
as possible.
There's two answers to that. One is they asked me if I had anything that I wanted to submit. It is the leading English language journal that I've published in since the very beginning of my career. And I felt it was also an important message to give to left analysts of class to to see the ways in which they can incorporate and articulate to these other traditions. So that was one reason. I think it would have been very tough for me to publish it in these two places, frankly. You know, and I didn't want to have to go through what would be a long and arduous and potentially unsuccessful review process anyway. I don't think AJS or ASL would publish it. And so then the question is, do you want to publish it in a more fringy but still mainstreamish journal or in the leading left journals? But instead of that, I didn't weigh the options that carefully. I've got this big representative at this conference in Johannesburg. What do you think? Let me do this little conceptual step-by-step guide to building up a Marxist concept. This is simply a way of thinking through the different dimensions and components of what is specific about the Marxian concept. Where you end up with is step seven, which is giving exploitation and domination as being the central mechanisms that give the Marxian concept its distinctiveness. But to get to that point, I think there's sort of a logical series of moves that helps to clarify what you're ending up with. So the first move is to have a very clear understanding of what it means to have a concept that's relational rather than gradational. We've talked about that a little bit already. One simple mnemonic for thinking about that is that if you have a concept that's relational, the terms within that concept each presuppose other terms. So the simplest case is you cannot define the category husband in discussions of the family without defining the category wife. To be a husband is not to have an individual attribute. To be a man is to have an individual attribute. To be a husband is not. You can't define a husband without defining a relationship to another category. Now, there are some ambiguous cases here, and that's the distinction between defining a category relative to another and defining a category in relation to another. The category poor can mean anyone who lives below a certain threshold of income, or it can mean that anyone at the bottom of an income distribution. Now, if it's anyone at the bottom of an income distribution, you are defining a category relative to another, because bottom of a distribution implies there's a top of the distribution. The word bottom doesn't mean anything except relative to top. But it implies no forms of interaction that bind those categories together. You can have a distribution of wealth in the world in 1497, so to speak, where you could talk about places in the world that had, on average, lower income by whatever criteria than others. Indians in the Amazon jungle had less calories per day than Italians at the time, let's say. But there's no, that's relative to each other, but there's no relationship whatsoever. That was a pointless example. I think the point is that relative is different from relational. One of my objections to Bourdieu's approach to class analysis is that I think he confuses relative position and relational interaction. His conceptual spaces and fields are all about relative positions. And it's often quite unclear what the social relations that bind people together. And by bind people together, I mean which organize their interactions, their practices, their activities, with respect to each other. So a truly relational concept relates the activities of people and their interactions, not simply in some quantitative sense their relative positions. And that's what class concepts do. very strong with. The class concept, slave master, is meaningless without the category of slave. But furthermore, it implies all sorts of things about their relationships. The slave master dominates, controls, and directs the activities of the slave. The slave is under the control of the slave master and is owned by the slave owner. You know, there's a rich and complex set of interactions between the actual activities of the people, not just the slaves are poor, slave masters are rich. Okay, so that's the first thing, social relation. Now, the term social relation, by the way, this is one of these terms in sociology. The very first day you take a sociology class as an undergraduate, you get the term social relation. It's an absolutely fundamental term to sociology. And, you know, some renditions of what is distinctive about sociology, the category social relation is the foundational concept. That's the bottom line concept of all sociology. It's not everybody would agree with that, but some people would say that. It turns out to be both the most fundamental category, the one that you hit the first failure in sociology, and one of the most elusive and difficult concepts. It's not an easy concept to really come to terms with. And part of the problem is it's not always clear what is being related in a social relation. To use some Latin jargon, what are the oblata of the of relation? What is it that's being related in that social relation? Is it the persons? The proper way of describing this classroom is that there's a social relationship between me as a professor and you as individual persons. Or is what's actually being related is our practices, what we do. Is it a relation among practices, activities, as opposed to the persons who are the performers of the activities or the actors? But it isn't the bodies, it's not the persons per se that are really related, it's our activities. It's so that the category wife and husband are really social roles filled by persons, and it's the roles. Roles is another language for talking about clusters of activities. The role is a specification of what you do. In some rhetorics, it's a statement of functions. That's a whole other language for talking about this. Well, this is just to tell you that it's not so simple as if you needed control of the notion of relations and simple. That's the first step in the Marxian concept, to really get, okay, we're dealing in a relational world. The second step we've talked about already, you have to figure out what makes a class relation a class relation as opposed to some other kind of relation. Lots of relations in the world. Gender, race, friendships, these are all relations. They all define categories which cannot be defined except in relation to each other, in which the relation has to do with their interactions, not just their statuses. So what kind of class relation, what kind of relation is a class relation? Well, here I think there are really two moves to be made. First is to define the concept of the social relations of production. Again, this is within the Marxian framework. The concept of social relations of production can be built in the following way, that any system of production has various kinds of assets that are used. This is a simple technical fact about the nature of production. You have tools, raw materials, all sorts of inputs into production. You can describe that the deployment of those assets, the resources that are used in production, means of production, raw materials, energy, whatever. You can define it in technical terms, like an engineer would. This is what economists call a production function. In the production function, a certain amount of labor of a certain type of skill would also count. That's one of the things that gets used in production. You can define it technically as a material process, or you can define it in relational terms, really, and, you know, both. You can define how those assets get deployed, how those resources get deployed in social relation terms. That is, who is directing what, who controls which of these assets, and how do the different actors who are engaged in the use of these productions relate to each other. That is a relational description of the allocation of these various kinds of resources. Now, note the following. All relational descriptions of the relation between an actor, a person, and an input into production are actually descriptions of relations between people. To say, I own and control the use of a hammer, I own a hammer, is not actually properly described as a description of the relationship between me and the hammer. That's a shorthand for a statement about my relationship to everybody else with respect to the use of that hammer. Hammer is a physical object in the world that obeys the laws of gravity, among other things. Many people would have use of it. To say I own it means that you have a relationship to me with respect to the use of it. You can't use it without my permission, or I'll invoke the wrath of the state to keep you from using it. I'll invoke sanctions and coercion to prevent you from using the hammer because I own it. So the social relations that define the relation between people and things are actually relations between people. And that's what the idea of social relations production is about. Specifying that a full array of complex relations between people with respect to the use of things in production. And then the key idea is that the relations between people over the use of those resources include, crucially, rights and powers, various kinds of power that people have with respect to those uses. And if those rights and powers are unequally distributed across persons, then we have a particular kind of production relations which we call class relations. Most abstract level class relations are relations of production in which the rights and powers of people over the allocation of resources are unequally distributed, where some people have power over others with respect to the use of those means of production. Eventually, as we'll see, but we won't now because we're running out of time, the relations of those unequal allocations of power over the use of things result in domination and exploitation. That's the key end point of the analysis, which gives real content to these more abstract notions. But we do have to stop because it's 12. I will finish up a little bit of this on Wednesday, but we'll begin the two-session discussion of exploitation. And feel free to send me emails about whether you like having correction film the whole thing this time, or let's keep the dialogue going about the process. And bring me back your name tags.